The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the last couple of weeks, I've been using something from the teachings from the Buddha as a kind of a springboard for discussion. And one week I used a couple of analogies that the Buddha offered. Last week I talked about a kind of a famous sutta. We went through a whole sutta. And today I'd like to talk about a parable that's in the Buddhist teachings. So the Buddha used all kinds of different methods for teaching. Sometimes he talked directly to people in terms of what are you experiencing and here's how to work with that. Sometimes he used analogy and he used parable also. So this parable is one that will probably be familiar to you. It's the parable of the blind people and the elephant. And as far as I know, I did a little bit of a research on the kind of the context of this parable, and it is an ancient Indian parable, probably was around before the time of the Buddha. From what I understand, the fullest description of this story is found in the Buddha's teaching. So that's the earliest full description of this story is found in the Buddha's teaching. So I'm going to read that to you, and then As a parable, kind of like, as a teaching story, it's got a moral at the end. It's got a kind of and at the end the Buddha says, and here's the point of the story. So I will read that also. So this is in the context of a slightly longer sutta, but we'll just focus on the parable today. So this is the Buddha speaking. Formerly, there was a certain king in this very Savatthi, and that king addressed a man. Come now, my good man, bring together all those persons in Savatthi who have been blind from birth. Yes, your majesty, that man replied. And after detaining all the blind people in Savatthi, he approached the king and said, all the blind people have been brought together, your majesty. Now, my man, show the blind people an elephant. Very well, your majesty. And he presented an elephant to the blind people, saying, this is an elephant. To some of the people, he presented the head of the elephant, saying, this is an elephant. To some, he presented the ear, saying, this is the elephant. To some, he presented a tusk, the trunk, the body, the foot, the hindquarters, the tail, the tuft at the end of the tail, saying, this is an elephant. Then the man, having shown the elephant to the people, went to the king and said, the blind people have been shown the elephant. Do now what you think is suitable. Then the king approached those blind people and said, have you been shown the elephant? Yes, your majesty, we have been shown the elephant. Tell me, what is an elephant like? Those people who had been shown the head of the elephant replied, an elephant, your majesty, is like a water jar. Those who had been shown the ear said, an elephant is like a winnowing basket. Those the tusk said, the elephant is like a plowshare. And on, a number of these say, and so at the end, after they'd all said their various views of what the elephant is like, they realized that they didn't agree, and they said, no, an elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that. An elephant is not like this, an elephant is like that. And they fought each other with their fists. It said, the next thing it says is, the king was delighted with the spectacle. The Buddha's response here, or the Buddha's moral here, is when people are deeply attached to their own views, seeing only one side of things, they engage in quarrels and disputes. So the point here is is one about creating a view and then holding to that view. Creating a view based, in this case, it's based on some information. It's based on actual contact with an elephant. It's based on some information. And yet so there's a perception, there's a recognition of something. Based on that perception, there's an idea created, a concept. So in this case, there was the perception, the actual touching, perhaps, of the leg of the elephant. So there's the contact there, and then there's the concept. So that's the perception, that's the contact. That's kind of the basic information that was received, this contact with the leg of the elephant. And then there was a concept form, and the leg of the elephant is like a post, for instance. And so there's a concept formed. Now that's very natural. I mean, so we move from a perception to an idea of what that perception is. It's a very natural thing to happen. And then based on that concept, what followed in this story is views, that this is the definition of elephant. This experience that I have, this concept I have, this is an elephant. Now, in thinking about this story, we might think this is a kind of a simple story, and we're not so, you know, we wouldn't be so subject to this kind of thing. But this process that's described here of going from some kind of a perception to some kind of an idea about that perception to a view or a belief about that idea, this is the water we are swimming in. We are living in this kind of world all the time. In fact, let's start with perception. So perception is very useful to us. Perception is kind of a way in which we recognize experience. And so, for instance, walking into this room, I see chairs, I see carpet, I see wall, I see door, I see windows, I see people, and that perception is something that happens very quickly. I don't have to think about it. So it's kind of like perception, the process of perception is about connecting what we are experiencing, what we're taking in, with things we've experienced before, and recognizing them. And so this basic process of recognizing what we're coming across, that's perception. And this is really useful. I mean, it's really, really useful that I can sit up here and not have to figure out that's a wall and that's a carpet and that you are all people sitting out there. When we came into this world, we didn't have all of those perceptions, and so we had to learn very rapidly. We had to start to learn what a person is, what a mom is, what a dad is, what food is, what we learn all of these, our perceptions, and then we begin to recognize them. And then our mind begins to not have to do so much work. And so the kind of, I think this is partly why babies sleep so much, because their brains are working overtime to come up with concepts and to begin to understand the world. But as we begin to have those perceptions and work with those perceptions and live in those perceptions, it's like there's a quick process in the mind that recognizes things so quickly that we don't have to work so hard anymore. And so this is very useful. It's really useful that we have these perceptions and we create these ideas about what's going on. So moving from perception to concept adds another layer of idea. So So the notion of, for instance, moving from like touching the elephant's leg and then saying, okay, an elephant is like a post. That brings in not only the concept of something it's familiar. So it's, again, it's pointing back to the way perception works, is to recognize something we're familiar with in the past, and we recognize what we're experiencing here and now based on things we've known in the past. But then we take that to be something more fundamental about this experience. So in this case, the people who touched the leg of the elephant now have the concept that an elephant is like a post. And that creates a view or a belief that then excludes other possibilities, excludes other options. So that's where the quarrels and disputes came in. Oh, an elephant's like this, an elephant's not like this. And you can kind of see, it's like, but I know this from my direct experience. You're wrong. This is what an elephant is like. So it's not incorrect to say, for example, that this part of the elephant is like this. And one person who wrote about this particular story said, I don't want to read that. It's kind of, this is from a technical kind of scholarly article, so I don't want to read it, but I will paraphrase that basically what this story points to is that in recognizing when there's differing views or differing opinions, it might be useful to recognize that each view might be an aspect of reality rather than the entirety of reality. And so one thing it says, it would be through a calm and careful sharing of one another's perception and a concerted attempt to coordinate these on the assumption that each captured a piece of the truth rather than simply being mistaken, that the contours of the whole elephant would begin to emerge for each of the participants in the conversation. And so this encourages conversation when we instead of having the idea of like holding to views as being, I'm right, you're wrong, allowing this kind of a conflict of views to create an opportunity for conversation to begin to explore different perspectives and what else might begin to be revealed. Maybe we can come up with a larger picture. This to me strikes me as a very useful analogy or parable for us in this particular time in our country with our differing political views, you know, to reflect on that. Maybe a conversation would be useful. So we often have an incomplete picture with our views. We often have an incomplete picture of the world. And yet the issue that this particular parable points to is that we are unaware and sometimes willfully unaware that our view is incomplete. We like certainty. We like thinking we know what we know is true. We don't like to question our beliefs. We don't like to think of them as incomplete or potentially mistaken. And so we ignore or we walk around believing that our views are a representation or are an accurate representation of reality. And this is where problems come in. It's not only in terms of quarrels that or to conflict that this kind of thing happens. It actually happens way more. Oh my gosh, it's like so phenomenal just how much we are informed by our concepts, our perceptions, and our views. Like we have beliefs about the world, we have concepts about the world, and those concepts influence how we take in information. It's like our beliefs, our concepts, are filters that encourage us to kind of search out things that confirm those beliefs. This is a psychological concept that's talked about as confirmation bias, that when we have a particular view, we tend to orient towards information that confirms that view. So, you know, we hold a belief. We tend to look out in the world and say, oh, well, that confirms my belief. And so that reinforces that sense of that truth in that, or the sense of that being true. What also seems to happen, not only do we orient towards things that we, towards views or situations that confirm our beliefs, we actively ignore or don't take in information that doesn't confirm those beliefs. So this creates a lot of suffering. And also, not only like in terms of relationships in the world, in terms of conflicts between different aspects of our cultures, but also internally. We have a concept, perhaps, you know, so these views, these perceptions that are created, they're not just created by our kind of bumping up against the world, like the blind person, essentially, bumping up against the world and creating a map of the world all by ourselves. We also get input from our parents, from our cultures, from our schools, from our friends. And so there's a kind of a shaping that happens. All of our perceptions, our views, our concepts are shaped by our conditioning. And so it's not only that you know, views about other people are shaped, but views about ourselves are shaped. Who we are, what we're capable of. And then we look at the world through those lenses, deciding what we can do, what we can't do, who we are, what's right, what's wrong. All of these views have been shaped by our conditioning, by our cultures. Now, in this particular story, it was just this one contact. You know, they touched the elephant and created this one idea about what the elephant is. And recently I heard some results of a study that point to just how powerful a single contact with information is. So there was a study that was done about this notion of how quickly views are formed and how much people hold on to them, how much they influence us. So there was this story was a study was done about people were given one of two stories about firefighters. Either a firefighter was a really good firefighter and they took a lot of risks and they were really honored as a very skillful firefighter. Another firefighter didn't take a lot of risks, and they were honored as a skillful firefighter. So they were given this kind of story about these firefighters. It was one incident that they said this particular person had this experience in being a firefighter. And so they got these two different groups got these two different bits of information. And then they were immediately told that this was completely made up, that it had no bearing in reality, that it was fake news. They were immediately told it was fake news. Sometime later, they were asked about their views about whether a firefighter who took risks or followed the letter of the rules of being a firefighter would be a better firefighter. And the views that had been formed followed very directly from whichever story they had been told. It was one exposure to the information. It was even only one data point that they were told about. They weren't told generally this was information about all firefighters. They were told one data point. They were immediately told it was not true. And still, it shaped their view. It shaped their view. It shaped their belief about what. This is the power of the first information we hear, I think. This is the power of how our views are shaped. That it's like, you know, we have this almost bias towards the first thing we hear as being truth. So there is a power to that first contact. There's a power to that. That if we are unaware, and this is the big piece that I think is where our practice comes in, where our mindfulness practice comes in, and where we can begin to explore kind of maybe beginning to undermine this propensity we have towards not examining our views, this propensity we have to take in information that confirms our views, to not take in information as it doesn't confirm our views. We can begin to be aware that we are holding views. This itself is something that most people are not so clearly aware of. They may be aware that they have a belief, but at some level that belief is understood to be a representation of truth. It's not held as a belief. It may not even rise to the level or surface of awareness at all that there's a belief. So many of our cultural norms, our cultural familiarities are like this. You know, that we, from the time we're children, you know, we learn not by somebody sitting us down and telling us, you know, this is how close you stand to somebody you don't know. This is how much eye contact you make with people when you first meet them. This is whether you touch them or not. This is how long you engage in a handshake with somebody that you've just met. All of this kind of information is absorbed through our culture. And there's a kind of a view or a belief of this is how strangers meet. You know, so it's a view that we have. And that probably is not recognized as a view or recognized as a kind of a perspective that's held until maybe we run into another culture and we feel a discomfort around somebody either standing closer or further away or holding onto our hand for longer than we're used to or looking into our eyes for longer than we're comfortable with. Until we meet another situation, we might think that this is just how two humans would meet each other. But then we begin to perhaps recognize that, oh, maybe this is just how my culture meets each other. So much of what we absorb in our learning as, you know, in our conditioning, it's below the level of conscious awareness. Until something happens, perhaps that begins to create some kind of a conflict or create some kind of a discomfort around those views. When our views get challenged, it creates suffering. It creates struggle. It creates a sense of unease. And so we can use that. We can use that unease. We can use that discomfort to get curious. Because anytime there is some kind of suffering, anytime there's some kind of struggle or unease, there is some kind of view or belief at work, probably one that's not so clearly seen. And so this is a good question for us. If there's some kind of a struggle happening, what am I believing right now? What is being believed? So I'm going to give a couple of examples of ways that perceptions, beliefs influence our experience. Some of these are simple, but it begins to point to just how pervasive this is in our lives. So at one point I was on retreat in Burma, and in Burma, the monasteries are pretty close to villages, you know, so there's a lot of noise from the villages that kind of infiltrate the monastery. It's not like a silent place, you know. It's more intense than this corner, you know. There's a lot of noise coming in this corner. Sometimes the motorcycles go by or the trains or whatever, but it's like that, only many times louder. You know, I got to spend 3 days listening to Chinese opera, which is very atonal sound. So, you know, so there's a lot of sound coming into the monastery. And one day, you know, one afternoon, I began recognizing that I'd been hearing a sound. And I don't know, when I first really kind of highlighted it, I think I kind of recognized that I had been hearing it. But finally, I was beginning to kind of enter into my consciousness. It was a kind of a squealing noise that happened regularly. Like every afternoon around the same time, this squealing noise would happen. And squealing, you know, I had heard squealing in my life, and the perception that my mind connected that squealing sound to was pig. So I knew that, you know, I knew that was a perception. I knew that I was that the mind had done that kind of recognition, and that made perfect sense to me. It's like, you know, this is a village. There's probably pigs on the other side of the wall. But this regular squealing that happened every day around the same time, and then my mind created or recognized the squealing sound as kind of, it had a quality of distress to it in my mind. And so I believed, what happened in my mind in that moment was that I believed that there was not only pigs on the other side of the wall, but that it was a butcher shop on the other side of the wall. And that every day at around that time, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they were slaughtering the pig for sale for the next day for the market. And so, you know, there was a lot of emotion with that. You know, there was compassion arose for the suffering of the pig that was being slaughtered. Now, I knew that this was a concept. I knew that this was an idea. I knew that I didn't actually know if a pig was being slaughtered. And so I recognized that it was a belief. I did recognize that. And yet, you know, it's like the perception was pretty strong that this was a pig in distress. And so there was that feeling of compassion, that feeling of connection with a life and the suffering of that life being lost. And so day after day, I would hear the sound and feel those feelings. And then one day, instead of doing sitting meditation at that time, I, for some reason, decided to do some walking meditation. And I was out walking up and down the monastery driveway, basically, about a quarter mile long walk. And I began to notice that there were these bats flying in the air, and they were flying really close to me, and they were squealing. And I realized in that moment that that was the sound I had been hearing. It hadn't even been a pig, much less a being slaughtered pig. It was a bat. The compassion, of course, vanished. No need for the compassion. So, you know, this story points to, first of all, how easy it is to misperceive, how easy it is to have a whole so there's the misperception and then a whole story around the misperception, a whole emotional response to that story. And it's all a construct of the mind. This kind of thing happens so much. Even in ways, I'd say mostly where this kind of thing happens is where there's a kind of a view or a perception that's close to what's happening. We see somebody who looks familiar. You know, somebody who looks similar to somebody we know from our past. And maybe that person from our past has treated us unkindly or unfairly in some way. And so we might recognize that we have a feeling of dislike for this person based on the way they look, but maybe not recognize the whole kind of complex of what has put that together. You know, the similarity of the person's body shape or something, that all may be hidden from us. We just have this gut feeling, oh, that person's not trustworthy. And we go on that. We sense that there's an intuition there that we should trust. So there's a lot of ways in which this kind of happening, this kind of situation unfolds in our lives. There was a recent, there's a kind of a new theory. Maybe we shouldn't say it's a new theory about emotions. It's a perhaps a new theory in Western science about emotion that's been kind of being talked about in various radio shows that I've been listening to lately. The woman's name is Lisa Barrett, and she wrote a book called How Emotions Are Made. I don't know if any of you have heard about this lately. But basically her theory is that emotions are not somehow an inherent thing in us, but that they are constructed, that emotions are constructed, and that we play a part and conditioning plays a part in how those emotions are constructed, that concepts are intimately connected with the construction of emotions. And she, in fact, points to that, you know, internally in our inner life, in our inner experience, there are basically four, she said, there's so much information going on in our system, in our physical being, that it's too much for our mind to really process. And so our physical system gives a very simple read on what's going on. And it does it in four things. It's either pleasant or unpleasant. This is the internal feeling, you know, the kind of visceral feeling. It's either pleasant or unpleasant, and it's either calm or agitated. And that is essentially the physical feeling that emotions are based on. Those four pieces kind of put together. And all of the range of emotions that we talk about, you know, so unpleasant, agitated, boy, that can be a lot. It can be fear and anger and irritation and impatience. unpleasant, agitated. So anything, any emotion, any specific we give to that emotion is based on ideas that we have, beliefs that we have, views that we have, things that we've learned. So she's pointing to this as a, so not only are our concepts informing how we meet the world in terms of our, you know, just I look out here and I see you as people, but also in terms of our emotional relationship to the world, concepts are inherently embedded in that. And as I think about that, you know, this is actually this notion of emotions being constructed. This is something that the Buddha has been teaching. And so when I say it's a new theory, it's essentially, it corresponds with what the Buddha has been teaching for 2,600 years, that that emotions are constructed. That, and I've seen this in my own experience, how when my mind has a thought about something, then that thought can create a whole world of emotion. It's not necessarily that motion is kind of sitting there under the surface, but there's a feeling or an experience of recognizing that as a thought arises, you know, a thought about somebody that we've had an argument with, there's that thought. Then that in the moment, there's not only that thought, but there's a reaction in the moment to that thought, which creates the emotions right now. It's not as if you're tapping into the old emotion that was created when you had that interaction. It's being reconstructed right now. So this is visible. This is available for us to see in our lives, in our practice, how emotions are constructed. And as we start to look at or think about the simpler emotions that the Buddha talks about, greed and aversion, those simple emotions that are kind of the ground out of which suffering happens. And when we want something and we want to kind of get it and hold on to it, when we want to get rid of something, that like holding on to that, pushing away, it creates a constriction. It creates a kind of in the moment, the feelings of greed, the feelings of aversion are painful. We miss that often because we are kind of leaping into the concept of how great it's going to be when I get that thing or get rid of that thing. And so that idea that I'm going to get that thing or get rid of that thing is pleasant. And so we kind of miss the fact that the greed or the aversion itself hurts. And so we recognize, we begin to recognize that these basic emotions that the Buddha pointed to as being the underpinnings for suffering, that those are constructed. Those are constructed partly based on an idea of getting that thing would be good. And so the greed is in our minds. It's constructed based on the view that getting that thing would be good. Or getting rid of that thing would be good. Aversion is based on a view or a belief that getting rid of that thing would be good. Getting rid of that thing is what will make me happy. Having that thing is what will make me happy. And so there's a belief underlying this emotion of greed and aversion. And not only that, you know, in terms of concepts, in terms of, you know, the whole constructed nature of our world. So the greed is constructed based on that belief that having that thing would be good. But the very thing that we want, or the thing that we want to get rid of, that too is a concept. we don't actually, there's not a way actually to want the thing out there. The thing that we want is the idea of the having. The thing that we want is the idea of some way that somebody will look at me, for instance. We want people to have a particular perspective on us. So again, we can begin to witness this. At one point on a retreat, I began to recognize that I was suffering a lot around going and talking to the teacher. And I really wanted to be able to report a certain meditation experience. Like, I wanted to go in there and give a great report. I had this idea, I want to talk about being able to see this thing. And at some point I recognized I had no idea what I wanted to see. I just wanted him to think I was a good meditator. That's really what I wanted. So it was a concept. It was an idea that I wanted. And so this whole notion of the creation of concepts, it is so powerful, and it is so embedded in the whole way that we meet the world. It's very hard to recognize and to see that our very meeting of the world is mediated through concept. And yet, even just knowing that can be really useful. Because as with the blind people and the elephant, if they really understood, you know, oh, this is a concept. An elephant is like a post. Huh, somebody else has got a different concept about an elephant. I wonder what's that about? You know, if instead of taking our concepts to be the truth, we began to recognize, I'm swimming in a world of concepts. What are my concepts? What are my beliefs? Then we might be able to start holding them more lightly and having the conversation. Not only the conversation with others about, oh, you have a different view than I do. Tell me about that. But also the conversation with ourselves. I had a view for myself that I was a failure. I had a view that I was no good. I was a strong view that created a sense of self-hatred. This was an internal view. The conversation began internally. We can look at kind of our mindfulness practice as being an inner conversation. It's like, what's actually going on here? Oh, there's this thought. Oh, there's this feeling of self-hatred that follows that thought. Do I believe that thought? Well, not consciously. I don't consciously believe I'm this rampant failure, but some part of me actually does believe this. Wow. So that we begin to have the conversation, not only in community, but with ourselves. What are our beliefs about ourselves? What are our concepts about ourselves? And is there any basis in reality for those concepts, those views, those beliefs? Sometimes there is some basis in reality. I mean, I do think there's a world out there. I mean, there's some people that taking this understanding, all that I know, all that I can experience actually is mediated through my brain, my mind, my sense organs. I cannot actually know what's out there. I can only know what my senses are putting into my consciousness. I can only know through that kind of level of perception and concept. And so it's really useful to have concepts. And there is some, I believe, my view, I do, this is a view, I think you're out there. I think I'm talking to people. I think there's a room here. I don't think this, like, I don't think I'm a brain in some, like, vat with, you know, sensors kind of putting, you know, impulses into it. I think this is actually happening. And yet, what I can know, what I actually can experience of this is mediated through concepts and views and is very prone to misunderstanding, misperception. And so knowing that, I can begin to hold those concepts, hold my perception of the world a little more lightly, be willing to have that conversation, either internally, like for myself, around that self-hatred, being curious about, what is this? How does it happen? How does it come to be? At some point, clearly recognizing that that self-hatred came to be based on believing a thought. And that understanding deeply undermining that whole pattern. So the power of that conversation, the power of the conversation externally in relationship, the power of what we could call an internal conversation of being mindful of what's going on, curious about what's going on, can really help to expose these concepts. And you know, as the Buddha said, when we are deeply attached to our views, those who see only one side of things engage in quarrels and disputes. And so it helps us to start to see multiple perspectives. Just understanding, just recognizing this whole kind of way concepts, views, and opinions work in our minds. So there's a couple of minutes if there's any comments or questions about anything that I've said. Yeah. And why don't you use the mic?
Thank you. Are you thinking of motivations as concepts?
So a motivation being something like,
I want to be perceived well. I want to be, yeah.
There's concept in there, you know. So pretty much in anything like that, there is concept. So what there's a concept of what it would mean to you to be perceived well. So there's an idea there of how that would play out. So there's a concept in there. Then there's also a concept of wanting that, or you know, that would be something that would be good for me. So there's a kind of a concept around what would be good and what would be helpful for me in the world. So there's concepts in pretty much anything that we do. But a simple question, and so I laid out kind of this entire kind of complex of how we go from perception to concept to belief, and then pointing to how all of that can lead to suffering. So I would suggest that if there's a time when there is some kind of struggle or suffering, that would be a good point. I mean, I wouldn't try to understand all the concepts that are at work in your system, in your mind, because it's like, there's too many of them. You're not going to be able to see them all. But when there is suffering of some sort, be curious about what concepts are at play here. What beliefs are at play here? And so if there were suffering around that I'd want somebody to see me that way, they're not seeing me that way, so there's a sense of some kind of conflict, then it might be useful to start looking at, well, what is the belief here? I need to be seen in that way to be okay. I'm not okay if I'm not seen that way. That's a kind of a deeper level belief that is operating. So begin to be curious about concepts and belief when they're suffering. That's what I'd encourage. But yeah, I mean, this it's so pervasive the way concepts and beliefs work that we're not going to be able to identify them all.
Thank you.
And we have to stop. So thank you for your attention.